Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast. I'm over in Florida and I've forgotten to bring my microphone, so I'm recording this intro straight into the laptop. I hope the sound's okay. So this week I've got an interview with Pierre Rochard, co-founder of the Nakamoto Institute, founder of Bitcoin Advisory, and the host of the Noded Bitcoin podcast. And if any of you have followed me on Twitter recently, you've seen that I've kind of been going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, trying to understand what I'm missing with maximalism, trying to understand why I've been blocked by a bunch of maximalists and the arguments I seem to be getting into and why they're happening. So yeah, I've been spending a bit of time going down the rabbit hole. I've been reading Saferdin's book, The Bitcoin Standard, and I've binged on Pierre's podcast itself. I think I listened to all 20, I think it's 20 episodes. I listened to all in about 4 days. Absolutely fascinating and kind of confirming a number of questions I had. Also leaving a few kind of ideas open that I wanted to question Pierre on. I've approached a few people and asked to have them on. I wanted to speak to a few different people who were kind of in the Bitcoin space. Pierre said yes. A couple of others said yes. A couple have said no. I think I've probably pissed them off. And I've had a couple ignore me. But yes, Pierre has agreed to come on. And I think he's a very good starting point because having a podcast himself, he obviously touches on a number of broad subjects with his guests. He's obviously a very smart guy, very knowledgeable with Bitcoin. He has a good, deep understanding of economics. And he's just a very warm person when explaining Bitcoin. So it was great to have him on. It was great to be able to put a number of questions I have to him, because I know there are people out there like me who maybe joined the space late, who maybe their first experience of crypto was signing up to Coinbase and seeing Bitcoin and Ethereum, or maybe even later seeing Litecoin and Bitcoin Cash, and have no bias, who don't understand why there are so many Bitcoin maximalists and what their view is, why they can't be more open-minded to projects. But it is starting to make more sense to me. And I was glad to get Pierre on, and I was glad to go through some of these topics. And I hope it's useful for any of you who've listened to it, who are kind of have a few questions maybe yourself. If you can, please do support the show. I know a number of people last week also supported the Ross Ulbricht campaign. I've been sharing my latest interview with Lynn out, so thank you so much for that. But yeah, if you can support the show, there's a few things you can do. Can you go onto iTunes and leave me a review? They are ticking over. I am getting more and more. Those 5-star reviews definitely help with the ranking. So thank you to anyone who's added one of those. You can follow me on social media. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, Steemit, Facebook, anywhere. My handle on everything is at What Bitcoin Did. And if you have any questions, you need any help, feel free to reach out to me and give me a shout. Feel free to follow me on my website. Go to www.whatbitcoindid.com and you can sign up to the newsletter. And if you want to email me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And please do share the show out with your friends and family. Every time it gets shared out, I see it on Twitter, and it really does mean a lot. So yes, please do that. Okay, on to the interview with Pierre. It's a good interview. I really like this. Have a good listen. If you've got any questions for me, please do email me. And also follow Pierre's podcast. I recommend going and listening to that and subscribing. I will, in the show notes, share the ones which I think help me the most in my understanding. Okay, look, I hope you enjoy the show. And yeah, feel free to reach out to me. Hi, Pierre. How are you?
Good. How are you, Peter?
I'm pretty good, thank you. Thank you for coming on. It's a transitional time for me at the moment. Just to give a bit of a background of why I wanted to talk to you, I entered what is essentially the crypto space about 18 months ago, and my entry was into Coinbase, and there was Bitcoin and Ethereum. And whilst I'd already heard of Bitcoin, I didn't have any kind of deep knowledge of why one was so much more important than the other. And I've gone through a journey of looking at a lot of crypto, buying altcoins, selling altcoins, making and losing money. But in doing my podcast, I've started to see more and more people block me on Twitter who are Bitcoin maximalists. So I've gone on a bit of a journey to try and understand it, and it's all starting to fall into place. So I thought this would be a good time to talk to you. And I also think there's probably a lot of people like me who innocently think there's things okay with altcoins and such. So I would love to talk to you a little bit about Bitcoin maximalism, why it's so important, and thank you also for all your podcasts. They've been very helpful. So What would you say some of the misconceptions are with Bitcoin maximalism and maximalism? Why do you think there is this kind of battleground that exists?
Yeah, I think that probably the biggest misconception is that Bitcoin maximalists think that that essentially it's a difference between a prescriptive, there should only be one coin, versus a descriptive, based on our understanding of monetary economics, the outcome will be such that most of the value will accrue to one coin, and one coin will be, you know, at the very least, the world reserve currency, or even more than that, just the one global money. And of course, there will always be coins on the side, you know, at the margin. And I kind of see it as like a Pareto ratio of 80-20. So I think that like 80% of the value is going to go to Bitcoin, and 20% of it is going to go to a mix of different, whether it's like local currencies or currencies that have specific utility functions or different marketing and memes around them, like Dogecoin. And that's just based on my understanding of network economics and monetary economics. It's not at all that, you know, I'm just pumping my bags.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And I've been working my way through Saifedean's book as well. And one of the very important sections in that was when he talks about when some countries were based on gold and some were based on silver. And those countries whose economy was based on silver saw mass devaluation of their currency and eventually move to gold, and it feels like there will be a winner takes all scenario with this.
Yeah, or at the very least a winner take most.
Yeah, so do you see any value in any other parts of this crypto ecosystem? Because I'm now coming at it with more of an objective view. I've pretty much been selling off everything and struggling to see any value outside of Bitcoin.
So I think that one of the issues we have in cryptocurrencies is that a lot of these projects essentially are successful at first and then only fail when they try to scale. And so there's kind of a dichotomy, and I describe it as either failing to scale or scaling to fail. And so to me, Bitcoin is at the layer one. Chose to fail to scale, which is that we're just going to choose to not scale by not increasing the block size limit. And then I think that Ethereum is a prime example of scaling to fail, which is that we're going to keep trying to scale until this whole thing falls apart. And we kind of saw on Medium, Stop and Decrypt has some really good articles on the properties of these decentralized networks. And essentially, the more you try to scale, the more centralized a network becomes. And the more centralized it becomes, the more vulnerable it becomes to arbitrary changes that the users can't really resist because they're done by an oligarchy or, you know, some cabal of powerful individuals.
Yeah, one of the things I think that's a difficult transition was there are so many different factors to understanding it. There are economic, social, political, and I'm not an economist. Actually, I used to work in advertising. You know, I'm not really political. I find the Bitcoin project and crypto really interesting, but the knowledge required to take you from, especially if you've come into cryptocurrencies maybe in the last year or two, the knowledge you have to get the full understanding is quite extensive. Do you not feel, therefore, it is natural for many people to float to altcoins and not really understand it?
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, I have this tremendous privilege in the sense that my background before Bitcoin was accounting and monetary economics. And I had started reading about monetary economics when I was a junior in high school in like 2006. And specifically from kind of the Austrian perspective, but I've also read quite a bit from neoclassical and Keynesian and all these different schools of thought on monetary economics. And so that was kind of the mindset I had coming into Bitcoin. which at the time it was only Bitcoin. And then I learned about Litecoin and I was immediately skeptical about Litecoin. So I've been a Bitcoin maximalist since day zero of getting involved. But I think that the mindset that people come to crypto with certainly dramatically impacts their analysis of the investment opportunity and also, you know, where they want to focus their time to be. So there's lots of people who came to crypto from a trading background. And so they're very focused on doing technical analysis of charts and doing day trading and things like that. So, you know, they're on BitMEX doing 100x leverage and having a great time. So, I agree that one's background heavily influences it. And most people don't have a background in monetary economics or in economics at all. And so then it just becomes a marketing thing of, you know, you log on to Coinbase, as you were saying, and you look at these different logos. You know, it might even just come down to the branding that someone decides to buy one coin and not the other. And then the other thing, too, is that there's just, because it's decentralized, there's resources all over the place. Often they contradict each other, and it's very hard to learn the ground truth of what's going on with these different networks and which ones have the potential to accrue value in the future and which ones are just pump and dumps.
That's very true. And also, it can be a very unforgiving place at times. So I made the decision to go out to Japan and interview Roger Ver because I wanted, from my perspective, to understand where he was coming from. And you know, I'm not a buyer or holder of Bitcoin Cash. I sold them immediately. But I wanted to understand from my perspective as somebody trying to enter the space. And I took a lot of flack for that and, you know, quite abusive at times as well. I understand it now, but I still don't regret the decision.
Yes.
Does that
make
sense?
For sure. I think it's unfair, actually, how much flack you got. And in fact, I think it's unfair that anyone who comes into crypto today and starts asking completely innocent questions that aren't motivated at all by some sort of political or whatever it may be. The issue is that a lot of people who have been in Bitcoin, and I've only been around since like early 2013, and now I'm considered to be like an old person here. But really, when I joined, like the people who'd been around since 2010, 2011 were the old people. And everyone since 2011 has heard all of the arguments, for and against increasing the block size limit. And it's kind of, it has been a perennial debate. And so on some level, people who've been around for a while just don't have the patience anymore to discuss the topic because it's beating a dead horse. And so what's unfair is that when new people come in, they don't have this whole history and they don't know, you know, all the arguments. So it's completely normal for them to want to discuss it. But people who've been around for a while and who understand that this is like Protestants versus Catholics and don't want to like, they don't have any patience for it. And I think that it leads to a lot of unnecessary acrimony when really it's just people trying to learn.
Yeah, and that's true, actually, because I think when you first start looking at the block size debate, it's very easy to be swung back and forth. Because you'll hear an argument for bigger blocks and you'll say, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Yeah, I mean, what the fuck's wrong with this? And then you'll hear a counter argument. Oh, yeah, and that kind of makes sense. And I think it's probably taken me a year to fully understand why I personally would not support bigger blocks. I mean, at one point I thought, well, maybe a marginal go to a 2 megabyte thing wouldn't have been a bad problem. But then I heard the debate between Jameson Lopp and Roger Ver, and the way Jameson defended block size was, again, really important. But I think it's very easy to be swung both sides. But for new people entering the space, it's very hard to find a solid, impartial argument. And you have to almost, you've got to throw yourself into a very intolerant place.
Yeah.
And get beaten around a bit.
Yeah, and maybe it's a good introduction to crypto or a good hazing to throw yourself into the debate of the block size limit and just it's a great way to grow a thicker skin. Ultimately, though, at this point, I think that it's we're in a healthier position now that we've had the Bitcoin Cash hard fork, because before it was like really a family feud, you know, within the family. And now we've had the divorce and they can live in their separate houses. And, you know, there's still a lot of acrimony, but it's a little healthier, I think.
Yeah. And another thing that I've also, something I question with myself is whilst, maximalist hate altcoins, generally shitcoins, I'm also started to hate them. I also think they've probably had a net benefit for Bitcoin for a number of reasons. The exchanges have given a use case, the opportunity to make money has increased exposure. And I also went to a Jimmy Song meetup on anti-fragility. And they also increase Bitcoin anti-fragility. So as much as they're hated, there's this converse or perverse thing where I think they've ultimately benefited Bitcoin.
Yeah, and they're also just inevitable. I think that the thing about altcoins is that Bitcoin can only go up in price by a certain amount. Like, and it's kind of unrealistic to think that, well, without altcoins, Bitcoin would be, you know, twice as valuable because all of that capital would have gone into Bitcoin. I don't think it would have. I think that Bitcoin's price is very psychological, and it would be very hard for the price to have gone to like $40,000 instead of $18,000. And so all of that capital flowing into the space essentially overflows from Bitcoin into other marginal projects. And, you know, we can criticize those projects, but they do perform an important function of absorbing a bunch of excess capital that is just incapable of being absorbed into Bitcoin. And then the other thing, too, is that I see that each of these different altcoins, it appeals to a different psychology and a different mindset of someone coming in. And so to me, they're all coming into the same building through different doors. And now, granted, my favorite door is the Bitcoin door. But ultimately, they do end up in Bitcoin in the sense that if someone's an altcoin aficionado and they're always, you know, they're looking through crypto coin market cap and trying to find, you know, what's going to be the next pump and dump and all this, or they're reading white papers and doing fundamental research to figure out what's going to be the next big crypto. They all have a position in Bitcoin, or should, right? It would be bizarre to me if someone has a portfolio of crypto that has a 0% allocation to Bitcoin. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, most of these people own Bitcoins anyway, and what they do with the rest of their portfolio is kind of their own business, and I see it as inevitable that they are A, going to be in altcoins, and B, going to be in Bitcoin.
It's funny because I almost feel I've come to this kind of full circle position. I now actually think the entire situation environment is perfect in that in some ways – the altcoins have, like we've discussed, have been great for Bitcoin, but actually having different types of Bitcoin maximalists is also great. Having, you know, open-minded, tolerant people who will talk to you is great, but also having the kind of extreme intolerant types are also actually is great because they will force like someone like me to rethink my whole position and actually reconsider it. Another area I wanted to explore with you, hyper-Bitcoinization, you talk about that like it's an inevitability,
yeah,
which I think is pretty cool. And also, I once read a book called Engines That Move Markets. I don't know if you know the book.
Yeah.
But it talks about the big changes which have changed society, so railroads, electricity, oil, telephones, internet. And I can almost see in the future an additional chapter being Bitcoin. Why, for you, is it an inevitability?
Yeah, so hyper-Bitcoinization is just a funny word to describe Bitcoin essentially replacing all of the government fiat currencies that we're currently using as money. And I see it as an inevitability because of, so there's a number of things. The first phenomenon to really describe is a speculative attack. And this actually, this phrase was coined by Paul Krugman, of all people. But he was using it to describe what was happening to currencies in Southeast Asia during the 90s. And basically what happens is with a money that is weak, that is that the government or the central bank is printing more of it than they should, it's going to be decreasing in value versus other monies. And with a fractional reserve banking system, it becomes a very profitable trade for traders to borrow in that weak currency and then sell that weak currency for a stronger currency. And that process of borrowing the weak currency actually creates more of it, because in a fractional reserve banking system, when banks lend out money, they're actually creating new money. They're not just lending out existing money. And so that actually further weakens the weak money, and you have a negative feedback loop there. And then the speculator can, as the value continues to diverge between the strong money and the weak money, the speculator can sell his position in the strong money and repay his loan, which was denominated in the weak one. And so, anyway, I hope that the audience followed along with that. But basically, what this causes is that the weak money has to tighten its monetary policy dramatically. And so we saw a speculative attack. George Soros famously did one on the British pound when it was trying to join the European Monetary Union. I would argue that there was a speculative attack against the U.S. dollar in the late 70s with gold. And so the value of gold dramatically increased because it was, in this scenario, the strong money. And ultimately, it was defeated by Paul Volcker, who tightened the dollar's monetary policy and had money supply targeting and interest rates skyrocketed to 20%. So that's how a government stops a speculative attack, is by tightening the monetary policy and strengthening their currency. So I think that Bitcoin is going to do speculative attacks against fiat currencies. And the only way fiat currencies are going to be able to defend themselves is by tightening their monetary policy. And how much you have to tighten your monetary policy is a function of how strong the strong currency is that you're competing against. And so with gold, it was like, okay, gold, if you think about it, as the price of gold goes up, as its value goes up, it becomes economical for miners to go out and mine more gold. And so the production rate of gold increases to cope with this demand. Bitcoin has a difficulty adjustment every 2 weeks, such that the Bitcoin miners during a bull market can't just start printing more Bitcoins, right? So there's a fixed every 10 minutes, they're going to create 12.5 and then 6.25 Bitcoins with the next halving, et cetera. And there's nothing that they can do about that. And so that makes it so that there's a much stronger supply function on the other end, which means that to fight off a speculative attack being propelled by Bitcoin, you'd have to tighten your monetary policy much more than you have to with gold. And I don't know that the financial system would be strong enough to survive such a tightening. And I don't know that there would be the political will to even do it. And so I think that what will end up happening is kind of an unknowable at this point. But the inevitable result in my mind would be that Bitcoin would be replacing a fiat currency one by one around the world as it performs these speculative attacks on them. And that's kind of why I see full currency substitution or hyper-Bitcoinization as inevitable.
Do you see a country like Venezuela as being the most likely to migrate to Bitcoin as its primary currency?
Yeah, so plausibly, I think that the problem right now is that we're too early, in the sense that I think that Bitcoin's market depth, its liquidity, needs to increase more before this becomes a realistic scenario. And a big part of that is having very good exchanges that are good fiat on and off ramps so that speculators can be accumulating and dumping Bitcoins easily. And so it actually, it's very hard, for example, in Venezuela, they have like currency controls. So it's very hard to buy and sell Bitcoins there. They do have like black markets, but black markets inevitably are very illiquid because, you know, they don't have like a centralized order book. And the other thing, too, is the way they get their Bitcoins in Venezuela is by mining them. And so they use their cheap electricity to acquire them. So and maybe we'll see a marginal adoption of Bitcoins in Venezuela, but I don't see them being as the first speculative attack vector.
I'm not sure if you've seen it. There is a project by one guy who's looking to airdrop Bitcoin across Venezuela. I mean, which comes with lots of problems, yeah, but it's kind of interesting.
It's interesting. I'm skeptical of those because I just think that people assign value to things based on how they acquired it to an extent. So if you give something away for free, I think people assign a value of zero to it and just want to get rid of it. And so I'm skeptical of that. Now, maybe it's the case that 90% of people assign a value of zero to it, but that 10% really does their research and realizes that, hey, this is a gift from heaven. And they become evangelists, and eventually, you know, they are causing hyper-Bitcoinization in their country.
One of the things that I find difficult coming from, I've come from a background where my political view is there's a left, there's a right. I don't really know much about economics, and I worked in advertising for 20 years, and I found the longer I've been in Bitcoin, the less I start shouting my opinion and the more I'm asking questions. I've got my first Austrian economics book sat downstairs waiting to be read after I've done safedeans. But one thing I'm finding very difficult to picture is how a government would operate in a world where Bitcoin becomes the primary currency. And I think a lot of people can't imagine that world because it feels so alien from where we are now. Can you talk me through how the kind of picture of a government how it operates and how the government services that are provided in such a scenario?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question because, I mean, we can look at history books and see that, and even today we can see that there are governments that essentially don't have sovereignty over their monetary policy. We've seen countries that have what's called dollarization, where the U.S. dollar becomes their local currency, and they have no influence over monetary policy, and yet the government continues to function. And so there's definitely examples that we can look at for that. And basically, it's that they find ways to tax value. And I think the easiest way and the most natural way for a government to raise revenue is by taxing real estate, because real estate ultimately can't move, and it's easily identifiable, right? So whereas with crypto, you know, it might be pseudonymous, and you never know who holds how much and who's sending transactions where, without doing like some very sophisticated chain analysis, and even that's imperfect. So it's definitely the case that taxation may become harder with Bitcoin, specifically, you know, with taxing transactions and income. But I think that taxing real estate will always be a way of raising funds for governments. And then the big loss is that they lost the ability to have an inflation tax, right? Which is that, you know, indirectly through a central bank or directly, printing money to pay for government expenses. And I think that that would actually be really good for accountability, because an inflation tax is arguably hidden in the sense that people don't really feel it. And that means that governments can be very unaccountable in the way that they spend that the proceeds from that. And it would be good if people really every penny counted, right? And so I think that that'll increase accountability. Now, granted, it may increase inequality, arguably, but we'll see. So I don't think that it'll be a challenge. Now, I think that it will cause a decrease in government expenses, and we can debate as to whether that's good or bad. Like, I think that people on the right would argue that that's good. People on the left would argue that's bad, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's quite a complicated thing to almost picture, and it's very complicated to understand the transition when you've grown up living one life with one fiat money. That actually, and also what is quite interesting is I talk to a lot of my friends who have got, they've got no background, none of them own Bitcoin, and when you try and explain the issues with fiat currency, debasing of currency, it goes over a lot of people's heads because they've had no experience at all of any of this. What do you think is a great way to start introducing people to these topics? You know, people who don't have this kind of background, and start to explain to them why this is so important.
Yeah, so ideally we wouldn't have to explain it, right? Because it's kind of a niche topic that I don't see why everyone should be educated about monetary economics, to be honest. It's kind of just a – and actually, so, you know, you're saying that it's hard to reason about these monetary economics concepts, but I actually think that the perhaps even the bigger issue is having to reason about the price. We've never had to deal with a money appearing out of nowhere with a value of zero and then going to having a value of billions of dollars and then going to like replacing other money. It's like, it's just historically unprecedented. We've never had anything like this before. And I think that it's actually, it's doing a lot of brain damage to people. And it has to me as well, right? Like during the bull market, I was like feeling manic because of what the price was doing. And humans just aren't meant to like cope with such dramatic changes in value over such a short period of time. It's kind of an evolutionary, unprecedented event. So I think the price itself is hard for people to reason about. And add on top of that, having to think about issues of computer science and monetary economics. It's unfair that God is doing this to us, but here we are. So I think that there's reading lists. So Saifedean put together a reading list to, it's kind of an intro to monetary or to Austrian economics. And his book itself has a long intro to Austrian economics to deal with this issue in particular. I think that it's strange because I don't think that everyone should be getting involved in Bitcoin because in a sense that either they're like intrinsically interested in it or not. And if they're not, then all they have to do is just buy some on Coinbase or whatever and, you know, get a Trezor and put it on their Trezor and hold it as like an insurance policy, as like a hedge, and just not think about it. Just walk away. Like, that's probably the healthiest thing for them, is to just walk away. Maybe I should have walked away and done that exact thing.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because one of my in this section, one of my questions here is there an inherent threat to not owning Bitcoin personally? You know, if hyper-Bitcoinization happens, is there a chance that people are going to be left behind and there's going to be a new inequality?
Yeah, so yes and no. Yes, just mathematically, right? Like if Bitcoin goes to having a purchasing power in today's dollars of like $100 million, then, you know, we've created a new set of millionaires and billionaires who are going to be consuming resources at other people's expense. So there's definitely that issue. But no, in the sense that the whole reason why I think that this is a good thing, Bitcoin, that is, and its adoption, is that I think that central banks, fractional reserve banking, and government fiat monies have done a lot of damage to economies. And we kind of saw that with the global financial crisis. But it's much more insidious than that in how much they reallocate capital and themselves generate inequality. So, you know, banks as the creators of money are the first beneficiaries of inflation, and they are the first recipients of money. So that itself creates inequality. And then the you have kind of the welfare warfare state that itself also creates not only inequality, but I think that a lot of injustice around the world in terms of arbitrarily bombing countries and killing people. So, and to the extent that Bitcoin would put a limit on the nefarious activities of governments, everyone would benefit. And I think that we would have much higher real economic growth rates, many more opportunities for people, both as entrepreneurs and as employees, to improve their lot in life and improve their standard of living. So in that regard, I think that it would just be beneficial for everyone, even if they don't own any Bitcoins going into it.
See, that's also interesting because that was one of the things I read in Safer Dean's book, that the move away from the gold standard leads to increased wars and increased time at war because there's more money to essentially create weapons. And also, it's another argument that is new to me that I've read a lot about, that taxation is theft. And people don't want their tax. And when I met with Eric Voorhees, he was saying he doesn't want his tax money being spent to bomb people in the Middle East. And I think that's something people can't get their head around early. And then that's made me have to think about a lot of things. Like, I've had to now start questioning the National Health Service, which in the UK is an institution. But now, actually, by studying Bitcoin and Austrian economics, I'm starting to realize, well, the NHS is essentially a socialist policy, which is theft from everyone else. And I start to, can you see how it can become quite confusing for people?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember, so I kind of went through this before Bitcoin, and when I was in high school and I was learning about Austrian economics, I was also taking an economics course in high school as well, and they were kind of presenting only the Keynesian and neoclassical perspectives. And I had this moment where I was like, why is it that I'm being taught things that, if I think logically about it, seem just wrong to me, and they don't make sense, and this Austrian economics stuff makes sense, but I'm being told by my professor that it's nonsense. And it caused a huge amount of cognitive dissonance, because up until that point, everything I learned in school I took to be true, you know, like whether it was math class, which is like, okay, you know, this is true, like this makes sense, or history class, okay, yeah, this happened. And then I started learning about, you know, libertarian political theory and also economics, and it caused a huge amount of cognitive dissonance, where at one point I had to sit down and decide, okay, what do I keep, like, going down this rabbit hole and, you know, causing myself this cognitive dissonance? Or do I just, you know, rethink things and start towing the government line on this, because it seems like an easier existence to go through? And so I do remember going through that. And, yeah, I think that it's interesting that Bitcoin is doing this. I didn't anticipate it. I thought that everyone would take Bitcoin and kind of mold it to their own worldview, to their existing worldview, and kind of shoehorn it in rather than actually changing their worldview on things. And it's gotten to the point that people are changing how they eat based on being interested in Bitcoin. They're like, oh, I'm going to become a vegan or a carnivore. You know, you kind of take on an extreme view of everything.
Yeah, I've seen all these well, funny enough, meetups, right, where you're going to have meat, the carnivores of Bitcoin, which also funny because I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah.
So I'm now questioning that. But yeah, there's so much to take on board and understand. And why is it that, you know, because I did economics at A level, which is 16 to 18 in the UK. We were taught Keynesian economics. Not once were we ever taught Austrian economics. And is this just is this some like insidious plan by the government to control education, like the things we hear about, or it is just Austrian economics not widely known or understood?
That's a really interesting question. I don't think that there is a conspiracy per se. I think that it's just that it's convenient, because this education is being provided by the government, and it makes sense that they would present arguments that are pro-government. And I wouldn't expect them to be very essentially, intellectually curious and wanting to show both sides of the argument when it's clearly to their disadvantage from a government perspective. But I don't think that it's like a cabal of individuals who decided that, hey, we're not going to teach Austrian economics. It's just it's evolved this way. And economics is also, there's just a lot of debate as to what methodology economics should have. And so this has been going on for centuries of different ways of thinking about it. And the other thing, too, is that economics is deeply tied into politics, and political economy is what it used to be called, and it is very highly political. So I think that when governments started doing, public education, and that was a very new phenomenon. That started in the 20th century, really, where the government was handling this whole bureaucracy of teaching everyone. I think that's when you really saw a divergence where Keynesianism became ascendant and Austrian economics became forgotten until the internet came along and these people started connecting the dots and being like, hey, look, this is like forbidden knowledge, basically.
But is it something you would have discussed with your professor and said, oh, what, this makes sense to me, this Keynesian stuff doesn't? Are they conversations you had?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I don't think it's a conspiracy is because they themselves don't even know what Austrian economics is. So they might have like one or two line, quips about it, that, the dismissive little sentences. But if you were to probe them about, oh, well, you know, what is praxeology? They're like, I've never heard the word before. So it's not like that they're taught Austrian economics and then taught why Austrian economics is wrong. In fact, there's just very little out there explaining why, from a mainstream perspective, is Austrian economics wrong. They just don't even bother engaging in the argument.
Are there any solid counter-arguments or areas within Austrian economics which are kind of gray areas, not even yourself, that you find difficult?
No, not really. I think that the arguments that I've read against Austrian economics, they inevitably slip into straw man arguments where they are refuting things that aren't actually Austrian economics, but they're the author's idea of what Austrian economics is. And I think that that's really a disservice to the profession of economics, that they haven't really taken it particularly seriously. And so I would be, if there are listeners out there who have very good arguments against Austrian economics, I'd be interested in hearing them. But I've been disappointed so far.
Yeah, it's like I say, it's new to me, and I'm trying to consume as much as I can, and reading Saferdin's book. I kind of just going through it and every page going, well, that just makes sense. I like, why has that happened? It was only I would say in the last 6 months I fully understand fractional reserve banking, which just seems now absolutely ludicrous. But I just don't think there are enough people who understand or question this. And like I say, it takes a long time for some people like myself. Okay, so that's really interesting. So just moving on, it's obviously been a kind of crazy year, the last year, with Bitcoin and altcoins. Prices going to $20,000, which was obviously insane. Do prices matter to someone like you?
Yeah.
Outside of your own gain?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that they are the litmus test, the prime indicator for where we are in the process of replacing these government currencies. And so I see the price as very important. And, you know, I understand people are, you know, who say, oh, the price doesn't matter. One Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. And that's fine as a soundbite. I do agree that the price day to day doesn't matter. And like people who are like, oh, you know, there's all this good news coming out, why isn't the price going up, or vice versa, like, that's nonsensical to me. I think that people try to read into the markets way too much. The bottom line, I think, is that basically the fundamental value of Bitcoin, if you want to call it that, is going up every day. And to me, the fundamental value is a function of time due to what's called the Lindy effect, which is that the longer something has been around, specifically a non-perishable good like Bitcoin, the longer we can expect it to be around. And so every day that goes by, I think the fundamental value of Bitcoin increases. And if markets were perfectly rational and run by robots, then Bitcoin's price would go up along with this fundamental value by X percentage every day, you know, in a mechanical nature, a linear increase in price. Now, because humans are deeply flawed and very emotional beings and subject to all sorts of cognitive biases, we don't have that. And so when Bitcoin's price is going up at a reasonable clip that is justified by fundamentals, we have momentum traders that jump in and they pile in, and they then, you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling process of the media seeing the price going up, people hearing about Bitcoin again. So I want to do a side note here. I think that so with time, so you worked in advertising. There's kind of this idea of like, the more times someone sees an advertisement, the more likely they are to then, when they're making a decision about what toilet paper to buy, they buy that brand. And so if they see an advertisement once, they might not necessarily buy that brand. But on the 10th time they see it, now when they go in the shopping store, they're going to buy that brand. And so I think it's the same thing with Bitcoin. And different people have different, you know, number of occurrences that they need to have before they buy Bitcoin. So for me, for example, it was two. I heard about Bitcoin twice, and then I bought some. And so some people, it's like 20 or 50 times. Yeah. That they're like, oh, that thing's still around? Oh, okay, maybe there's something there. Let me go read about it. Let me go open an account on Coinbase and buy some. So anyway, so they hear about Bitcoin because the price is going up and it's in the media, and they buy at the worst time possible, or really, I mean, not necessarily, right? Because the media was talking about Bitcoin at $4,000, and it was an all-time high, and people would be like, oh, don't buy at $4,000. Wait for a correction. Yeah. Okay, well, we still haven't corrected down to 4,000. I'm not excluding the possibility that we do, but you know, that my point is that or they buy at $18,000 because, you know, they're panic buying and they think it's going to go even higher. So all this to say that
all they say, aren't I too late?
Yeah,
that's the question I get. Like, aren't I too late?
So all this to say that the price overshoots the fundamental value and has a huge run up and then crashes because you run out of marginal buyers and the momentum traders go in full reverse and dump essentially. And so then it probably overshoots on the downside as well, is that the price goes below what the fundamental value is, and then you have a slow recovery from that bear market. So I think that the price is important if you take into account that it's going to have these oscillations around the fundamental value. But ultimately, it is a good indicator of where the fundamental value is if you think about the mean reversion.
And I guess, therefore, you embrace and support derivatives. You hope for an ETF, and you embrace futures because it's wider acceptance and it embeds Bitcoin within the financial systems.
Yeah, so there's two different points of view on things like that, which is one point of view from kind of the cypherpunk decentralization point of view. It's like, oh, you know, if you don't own your own keys, then those aren't your Bitcoins. And, you know, the government is going to seize all of these Bitcoins that are held by an ETF, or the futures are manipulating the price down, and all this rhetoric. And I sympathize with it a lot on an ideological level. But from an economic perspective, all of these financial instruments are inevitable, but also dramatically increase Bitcoin's liquidity and dramatically increase the total addressable market of people who can gain exposure to Bitcoin, and ultimately, you know, are driving the price of Bitcoin up, which I think is a positive. And while a cypherpunk might not necessarily go buy the Bitcoin ETF, he or she still indirectly benefits from its existence. And I do see it as kind of a Trojan horse. You're right, that it is embedding itself in the financial system and ultimately will help facilitate speculative attacks against that very same financial system.
And it's quite interesting that there's obviously been quite a firm regulatory lens over the whole crypto ecosystem over the last year. But it seems that there are no real problems with Bitcoin. It's everybody else who has to be worried.
Yeah, I mean, there's problems for Bitcoiners, like Jameson Lott pointed out that he got swatted. And so we are seeing like instances of people, Bitcoiners getting burglarized. And so that's no good. But I don't know if that's what you meant. Sorry.
No, I meant like on the regulatory side of things, you know, with the SEC looking at things, it seems like Bitcoin is outside of any kind of regulatory framework and regulatory risk, whereas things like Ethereum, Ripple, everything else, which they all seem quite ridiculous now, seem to have a quite high threat.
Yeah, I think that it goes to the origin story of Bitcoin and also its current state of decentralization. So in terms of the origin story, that's kind of what differentiates Bitcoin from Ethereum. From a kind of a regulatory perspective. Now, arguably today, they are both decentralized enough that they are no longer, that Ethereum is no longer, you know, suspect from the SEC's perspective. That's kind of what they've been saying. But the origin story, you know, SEC people or lawyers who say that Ethereum is okay today, they themselves say that, well, you know, in the past, maybe Ethereum was a security because of the way that it was pre-sold to the public and issued. So I on an ideological level, I do think that that's an attack on Ethereum's purity, if you want, of its origin story. But I don't know that it ultimately matters from an economic perspective. Now, I think that the greater threat for Ethereum is that is the scaling issue, and will it become increasingly centralized and revert back into not being a security, but being subject to regulations in the sense that there is kind of a centralized entity that the government can go knock on the door of, whether that's, you know, consensus, Infura gateway or whatever. And you have the same sort of thing with like EOS, where it's like this cabal of 21 people not only are they easily co-opted by governments, they've become a government of their own. And so now they're like talking about censoring Ponzi schemes. I think that, yeah, these are very good counterexamples when trying to explain that Bitcoin is decentralized and is not controlled by any group of people. And we saw that with like No2x and UASF last year, but we continue to see that in contrast to other altcoins.
Yeah, the Ethereum thing's really interesting because obviously I told you when I first used Coinbase, it was Ethereum and Bitcoin. So I looked into both of them and Ethereum seemed interesting and cool. And it seems now just to have become a place to launch scams. I don't really fully understand its purpose long term. One thing I think is a shame is that Vitalik seems like a very smart guy. Is it actually not a shame that he isn't part of the Bitcoin community and working on Bitcoin directly all the time rather than essentially wasting his time on Ethereum?
Well, I mean, this kind of goes back to our discussion about the value of altcoins, because essentially I think that he's brought a lot of people into crypto who are interested in non-monetary True. Applications of the technology, and then they a lot of them that I've met personally find their way back into Bitcoin, and they kind of become disillusioned with Ethereum. So there's some value there. The other thing is that I think that it provides a pressure release valve on Bitcoin. Because if Vitalik and other developers who are very interested in issuing assets on top of a blockchain had stayed in Bitcoin and had gotten their way of making Bitcoin more amenable to issuing quote unquote smart contracts or, you know, DAOs and ICOs and all this on Bitcoin, who's to say that we wouldn't have had like the DAO hack, you know, where a lot of community members lost millions of dollars and then forced a hard fork onto Bitcoin, essentially, and caused another split in the community. So I think that it's kind of good to offload all of this onto altcoins, because I think that building a capital market, so the issuance of equity and unregistered securities onto a platform, I think creates a negative externality on the monetary applications of that platform. And so I think that it's kind of good that those things get separated out. And I'm not excited about things like rootstock or collared coins. I'd rather those stay outside of Bitcoin and Bitcoin remain 100% focused on the issue of money and payments.
Right. Okay. So back to Bitcoin then. Obviously, I said I've been through all your podcasts. There's a lot of interesting discussions about different areas of development in Bitcoin. What projects are interesting you at the moment and why?
So I think the Lightning is interesting because it's related to payments. And really, I think the other developments that are happening is, first of all, Schnorr signatures, which is going to improve scalability and open up opportunities for further improvements. And I think the big kind of holy grail right now is the issue of fungibility and privacy. We see a lot of altcoins that essentially market themselves against Bitcoin in the sense that they are more resistant to chain analysis and people trying to figure out where funds are going on the public blockchain. So there are developments in the works, in the pipeline, which would facilitate coin-join transactions so that we have more mixing on by default in Bitcoin and then improve, essentially have it so that you have privacy and fungibility going in and out of Lightning channels. But I really think those are really marginal in the sense that they don't affect what I think is the primary driver of Bitcoin's value, which is its monetary policy. So anything that doesn't affect Bitcoin's monetary policy or the credibility of it, to me, it's just the cherry on top. It's not really a huge improvement for Bitcoin. So what I'm most excited about in Bitcoin is it continues to just do what it's been doing for the past years. And that, I think, is enough.
Yeah. The Lightning Network obviously seems very exciting. What are the misconceptions about Lightning Network as well? Because there are, if you do search, there are plenty of counter-arguments against it. Is that just FUD?
No. There's lots of very good arguments against it. I think that the biggest misconception about it, I think, is that it's seen as a necessity. And so it's seen as like, if Lightning Network fails, then the value of BTC will crash and that it will be an indication that Bitcoin has failed to scale. I think that there's plenty of... And so I think that the argument that people like Safedean make and that I would make as well is that, let's say Lightning Network and trustless layer 2 is just impossible. You can have a trusted layer 2 layer, and that would be like Coinbase, right? Where on Coinbase, you can send Bitcoins from one Coinbase account to another Coinbase account, and that never hits the blockchain. And so that layer 2 is in Coinbase's database, and it's trusted, and it's basically like a bank, you know, how a bank works. And the risk there is that that degenerates into fractional reserve banking, and we end up back with the system that we had. I think that the mitigation to that risk is that ultimately you can settle on chain and that banks will crop up and compete with each other and avoid the problems that we had with government oligopolies or monopolies with central banking, where essentially you have like hundreds of central banks competing with each other freely on the free market with a system that is fundamentally open and open source and open access and permissionless. So I think that while that wouldn't be the ideal outcome, you could scale without ever having a trustless layer two system. You can scale with a trusted layer two system. So I think that's the number one misconception. The number two, I guess, is, I mean, these are silly, right? Which is that Lightning is an altcoin. I think that's kind of like the most absurd one. and then that Lightning itself is lends itself to fractional reserve banking. I think that's kind of absurd. Like, that's just not how Lightning works. It's 100% reserve. And it has kind of the same... it has the same guarantees around that as layer one, because ultimately these are just signed Bitcoin transactions that you're transmitting around without ultimately broadcasting them to the network. But they have the same guarantees as layer one has with regards to 100% reserve. But it has major drawbacks. I think that having to be online all the time is a huge drawback, and having to have a hot wallet have hot funds is a major drawback. And these are kind of technical engineering drawbacks, but I think that in terms of the use case of using Bitcoins as your day-to-day money of making payments, the biggest drawback is not an engineering drawback. And this is kind of specific to the US, but I think that other countries have this problem as well, is that you have to pay capital gains taxes on every time that you spend your Bitcoin. So we don't have wallets that have very good accounting software that calculates your capital gains for you automatically. And so I think that's like the biggest drawback, and no one talks about it. The Bcash people don't talk about it. And really, that's what's holding back the retail usage of Bitcoins the most, or crypto in general.
Yeah, it's funny. I think Lightning's interesting, but it's not something I'm screaming out for. I buy things with Bitcoin. They tend to be like, I've got some miners, so I pay my mining fees. I've got a guy who works with me. I pay him in Bitcoin, and you know, whether it takes an hour or a couple of hours to confirm, it's never been a problem. I'm not screaming out for it. And my only worry with Lightning is that when it comes out, people just don't use it as much as it's expected, because it's not what it's designed for, as you said. So look, this has been really interesting. Go on, sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say the other huge criticism of Lightning is how different it is from Bitcoin. And arguably, Lightning is more... If you were creating a payment solution, adding Lightning is more involved than adding Bcash. Because like Bitcoin and Bcash have the same, like, you know, is structure to them, whereas Lightning is just a completely different new world with channels and invoices and all of these different concepts that you got to wrap your head around and implement.
It's quite interesting. When I had my miner set up, when the guy first set them up, he set them up with a switcher to switch between Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, which was the most profitable. That switched off. It's just Bitcoin now. But I had to transfer my Bitcoin Cash out and sell them. And I don't think there was hardly any difference in speed of transaction between that and Bitcoin. I don't remember thinking, oh, this was quick.
Yeah, well, I mean, they still have a 10-minute block time. But I think that we haven't really seen the competition in the sense that, like, well, we did in December, but you know, you only really see the difference in transaction fees when Bitcoin's mempool starts filling up and we have a backlog in Bitcoin. And that might ultimately drive more usage of Lightning, but we'll see. It's still very early.
All right. Well, listen, I'm conscious we've done an hour, and it'd be cool to, if you close out, just tell us a little bit about the things you're working on and who you want to hear from and how people can get in touch with you, and I'll share that all out in the show notes as well.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at Pierre_Rochard, and I'm on there probably too often. What I've been working on, I've been playing around with Lightning as well, and then just learning as much as I can. I just took Jimmy Song's programming blockchain course. I'd highly recommend it. Reading Mastering Bitcoin, and trying to see, basically I want to improve the wallet situation in Bitcoin, just learn as much as I can. Despite being around for years, it's an onion that you can keep peeling and keep learning more. So I still don't know everything. I know that I'll never know everything, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for doing this as well, because my audience is probably a little bit newer to the space, and say maybe yours, and some of these more basic questions that I know are things people want to ask, but sometimes we're a bit scared to ask. So thanks for doing it, and maybe in the future we can go into a bit more in depth.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'd be happy to come back on.
Okay, thanks, Pierre.
Thank you. Bye.
So what did you make of that? Was that useful to you? I mean, it was really useful to me, and I would definitely like to get Pierre back on the future and maybe go into some more detailed subjects. It's very early on for me. Some of these kind of deep technical and economic and philosophical ideas around Bitcoin take someone like me a bit longer maybe than others to understand. And I am doing my best to expand my knowledge. I am, as I said, I've listened to every one of Pierre's podcasts. I'm pretty much halfway through Safer Dean's book, The Bitcoin Standard, and I'm reading more and more about Bitcoin, and the arguments as a single monetary unit are starting to make a lot more sense to me. But I hope it was helpful to you. I am working on getting some more Bitcoin people to come on the podcast. I've got a couple of people who said yes. I've had a couple of people say no. But yes, I've had a couple of people say yes, and I want to explore this further, and I will obviously share out my knowledge with any of you who listen to it. Lastly, please do support the show. Please do leave me a review on iTunes. Follow me on social media. I'm at WhatBitcoinDid at everything. Go to my website, www.whatbitcoindid.com, and follow my blog. Share the show out with your friends and family, and obviously feel free to email me if you have any questions. I pretty much get back to everyone, and my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. I hope you all have a fantastic week, and I will see you soon. Bye.